listening to the CreepyBits AI Digest, where we break down complex AI concepts into actionable insights. Now, here's today's deep dive.
So, picture this. You're sitting at your desk, and you download this brilliant, brand new, like, 22 gigabyte AI model.
Yeah.
Right. You've read all the papers, you've seen the astonishing sample outputs everyone is posting over on Hugging Face, and you are just, you know, you are ready to run it locally on your own machine.
The dream.
Exactly. The local AI dream. So you wire up your comfy UI nodes, you get everything perfect, you hit queue, and you just watch your terminal, and instantly, I mean, in a fraction of a second, your VRAM usage spikes to literally 100%.
I've all been there.
The console throws this massive out-of-memory error, the kernel panics, and your machine just completely hits a brick wall.
It is the absolute worst feeling.
It really is. So what do? You do what literally everyone in the local AI space is doing right now. You go right back to the repository and you start looking for the quantized versions.
You look for the compromise.
Right. The shrunken, compressed files. And you find one, and sure enough, it fits in your VRAM perfectly. The generation actually runs. But, and this is the core of what we're talking about today, the moment that image actually appears on your screen, you are just kind of paralyzed by this nagging underlying question.
Which is, by shrinking this digital brain, did I just completely lobotomize it?
Yes, exactly. Did I just break the math?
Yeah.
And that is the defining anxiety of the modern local generative AI space right now.
It absolutely is. Because, I mean, we are seeing these massive models, right? Things like Flux 2 and QuenImage. They're scaling up their parameter counts at a rate that is just, it's completely detaching from the reality of consumer hardware.
Right. Like nobody has a massive server rack in their bedroom.
Exactly. And because you, as a local user, are basically forced to quantize, which is, you know, systematically discarding mathematical precision just to be able to load the model into memory, you're left wondering if the structural integrity of the neural network has been fundamentally compromised.
Which brings us perfectly to the core of today's deep dive. We are looking at this exceptionally rigorous, incredibly detailed technical breakdown from a researcher named Zano.
Yeah, over on the CreepyBits blog.
Right, the CreepyBits blog. Mm-hmm. The piece is titled Quantization and Quality Degradation. And what makes Zano's approach so completely different from the usual, Reddit or Discord discourse that you see every day is this absolute refusal to rely on the standard eye test.
Yeah, the eye test is, it's fundamentally flawed.
Right, because it's just people arguing, right?
Exactly. It relies entirely on biological perception,
right,
and subjective aesthetic preference.
Yeah.
You know, two people looking at the exact same generated image will just argue endlessly about whether the lighting is too flat or if the texture feels a little muddy.
Oh, it looks plastic to me. No, it looks hyper-realistic to me.
Exactly. It's useless for actual data science. But Zano bypasses all of that psychology. Bypasses human visual perception entirely.
Which I love. Zano basically treats this whole thing as an objective, rigid computer science problem.
Because it is.
Right. So our mission today isn't to figure out, like, how to generate images faster or which specific model is, quote unquote, prettier. We are looking strictly at the raw pixel level mathematical reality. We want to answer the big question definitively. What is the exact quality versus performance trade-off in the Blackwell GPU era?
Right. When we squeeze these incredibly complex models into microscopic digital containers, things like NVFP4, does the underlying math actually break down?
Right. So to answer that, we really have to start by looking at the anatomy of visual error itself.
We do. We have to establish a testing methodology that is completely divorced from human bias.
So let's get right into Zano's two-step visual proof system, because really this is the foundation of the entire argument today. If you're doing local generation, you might be familiar with the concept of a difference map, but Zano uses it in a very highly specific way to actually expose quantization failure.
Precisely. So step one is establishing the baseline difference map.
Okay, walk us through how that works.
All right, so Zano basically generates an image using the completely uncompressed full-weight model, that's image A. Then he generates a second image, image B, using the quantized compressed model.
And everything else has to be identical, right?
Exactly. The prompt, the seed, the sampler, the scheduler, the step count, every single variable is completely locked down. It has to be a perfectly identical pipeline. And then the software simply compares the two output images, literally pixel by pixel.
Right. It basically just subtracts the RGB values of image B from image A. Uh-huh. And if the result of that math is just a pure, completely black canvas, then you have mathematical parity.
Yes. To the naked eye, at least on standard monitor brightness in your standard color gamut, there is absolutely zero discernible difference. The quantization, in that case, appears to be totally lossless.
Right, it appears lossless.
Key word there, yeah, because a pure black difference map is often a massive deception.
This is where my mind was kind of blown reading the source material.
It's crazy, right? Standard 8-bit or even 10-bit monitor displays actually mask an incredible amount of floating point variance. The monitor literally cannot display the tiny mathematical differences that are actually there.
So the math is different, but your screen just shows you black because it doesn't know how to show you almost black but off by a thousandth of a decimal.
Exactly. And this is where Zano introduces the second step of the proof system, which we can really think of as the microscope.
The gamma-boosted visual noise analysis.
Yes.
And this is where it gets absolutely fascinating, because Zano takes that pure black difference map, the one that looks perfectly fine, and applies a massive 500% gamma boost to it.
Which is extreme.
It is. And just to be clear on the mechanics here for you listening, we aren't just taking the image into Photoshop and cranking the brightness slider all the way to the right. A gamma boost is a non-linear operation.
Right. It's a completely different math function.
Exactly. It aggressively amplifies the values in the extreme dark end of the spectrum, while essentially leaving the highlights relatively untouched. So we are forcing the rendering engine to take the absolute faintest microscopic mathematical discrepancies, like we're talking about differences of maybe a fraction of a decimal point in the tensor calculation, and blow them completely out of proportion so they become visually obvious to the human eye.
Exactly. We are looking specifically for the rounding noise.
Rounding noise.
Yeah. Because when you quantize a model, you are fundamentally truncating the bit depth of the weights.
Mm.
You are forcing your GPU to just round off the math.
Yeah.
So this 500% gamma boost visualizes exactly how that rounding error propagates through the entire diffusion process and eventually lands on the final pixel grid.
It's kind of like I was thinking about this analogy earlier. It's like looking at a freshly painted, completely black wall.
Okay, I like this.
Right, so to the naked eye, you look at the wall, it's perfect. That's the baseline difference map. It's just a black wall. But if you take a massive, like 500-watt floodlight and you shine it right up against the paint at a sharp angle, that's the gamma boost, you suddenly see every single tiny brushstroke, every tiny speck of dust, every imperfection in the drywall.
That is a perfect analogy. You're exposing the microscopic topography of the error. And what we are actually looking for in that boosted noise is really crucial, because it tells us whether the model is merely doing some harmless rounding or if the math is actively collapsing.
Right, because there are two very, very different visual patterns that emerge under that 500% floodlight.
Yes.
So let's talk about the good pattern first. If you apply the boost and the image basically just looks like uniform, high frequency, static, you know, just random film grain spread evenly across the canvas, that's actually a good thing, right?
It is. It's the absolute best case scenario for any kind of quantization.
Yeah.
If you just see uniform static, it indicates that those truncation errors we talked about are essentially just acting as low-level thermal noise.
Just background static.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The errors are random, they are microscopic, and most importantly, they are not correlating with the actual semantic structure of the image itself.
Right. So the AI is still perfectly drawing the object. It's just a tiny bit fuzzy at the math layer.
Yes. The mathematical foundation of the object the AI is trying to draw remains completely intact. The manifold is stable.
Okay, but the bad sign, the indicator of structural failure, that looks completely different under the gamma boost.
Oh, it's a huge red flag. The red flag is when that random static isn't random anymore. It begins to cluster. It starts to form recognizable shapes.
Which is so airy to look at in the article.
It really is. If you apply that gamma boost and you suddenly see, like, the faint, ghostly outline of a building's edge, or the distinct silhouette of a subject's face.
Or, like, massive banding in what's supposed to be a smooth color gradient.
Exactly. If you see that, that is catastrophic structural failure.
Because it means the mathematical errors aren't just random static anymore. The errors are specifically localizing exactly where the model is actively trying to calculate a complex geometric boundary or really subtle transition in the lighting.
Correct. It means the quantization process has actually removed so much precision from the model that the neural network's internal representation of that specific feature has essentially collapsed. It literally lacks the mathematical vocabulary to resolve that specific edge or that specific gradient.
The manifold has just broken.
The math is failing.
But, you know, I want to play devil's advocate here for a second, because I can already hear the counter argument from the heavy compression crowd, people who love running tiny models.
Sure, let's hear it.
If I have to use this highly nonlinear, completely extreme 500% gamma boost just to even see this structural failure, why should I actually care? If the unboosted image looks totally fine to my eye on my normal monitor, isn't this just pedantic pixel peeping?
It's a fair question, and it might seem that way if you're just looking at a single image in a vacuum. But in a functional professional pipeline, those microscopic structural failures are essentially ticking time bombs.
Ticking time bombs? How so?
Well, let's say you generate an image. Right. Looks perfectly fine to the naked eye. But under the hood, mathematically, there is a severe structural failure right along a high contrast boundary. If you take that image into an upscaler later on.
Oh, right.
Exactly. The upscaling algorithm is going to grab on to that clustered mathematical error, assuming it's real detail, and it'll magnify it. And suddenly you have this massive, highly visible artifacting right in the middle of your upscaled image.
Oh, wow. That makes total sense. Or what if you're doing like post-processing?
Exactly. If you apply a heavy color grade or you drop a LUT onto the image that just happens to boost the specific tonal range where that invisible failure occurred, the image will literally tear. The gradient will break apart.
Okay, so it ruins your downstream workflow. And I have to imagine it's even worse in video generation, right? Because temporal consistency would just be an absolute nightmare if the math is unstable.
It's a complete nightmare for video. Because in video generation, if you have a structural failure on a gradient in frame one, and then the noise seed shifts even slightly in frame two, which it always does, that invisible mathematical failure is going to manifest as this highly visible strobing flicker across the gradient as the video actually plays.
Like the pixels are just vibrating because they can't figure out the math frame to frame.
Exactly. The structural math matters immensely because it fundamentally dictates the fragility of your final output. So Xano's Gamma Boost isn't just, you know, snobby pixel peeping. It is literally stress testing the load-bearing walls of the generated image.
Okay, I am completely sold. The difference map plus the gamma boost is the ultimate lie detector for AI models.
It really is.
So we have our diagnostic tools. We have the pixel level difference map to check for standard deviation, and we have the 500% gamma boost to check for structural manifold collapse. But before we can start pointing these tools at the really wild, highly experimental, deeply compressed formats like NVFP4, Xano has to establish a control group.
Right, you need a baseline.
Exactly. We need to look at the absolute gold standard of precision. We need to compare FP32 versus FP16.
Full precision versus half precision. This is the bedrock from which all quantization is ultimately measured.
And Xano uses the SDXL model for this specific baseline test. Now, I do want to mention, Xano notes a very specific quirk here in the source material that we should probably just address quickly.
Right, the dual encoder setup.
Yeah, SDXL uses two different CLIP models, which actually requires a slightly different prompting methodology compared to the newer Flux models we'll talk about later.
Yeah, the architecture basically requires you to balance your prompt phrasing between the OpenCLIP text encoder and the standard CLIP VI-Duel, just to get optimal prompt adherence.
Right. But for the sake of this specific test, the mechanics of how the prompt is generated don't actually invalidate the math of the test itself.
Not at all. Because Xano used the exact same carefully crafted prompt, the exact same seed, the exact same scheduler settings to run the FP32 version against the FP16 version. The scientific control there is completely airtight.
Okay, perfect. So let's talk about FP32 32-bit floating point. In computer science, I mean, this is basically the heavy artillery.
It is the absolute uncompromised standard for model training. And to understand why it's so heavy, you kind of have to look at what floating point or logarithmic actually is under the hood.
Break it down for us.
So 32-bit float uses one bit for the sign, you know, telling the computer if it's positive or negative. Then it uses 8 bits for the exponent. And finally, it uses 23 bits for the fraction, which is also called the mantissa.
23 bits just for the fraction.
Exactly. That gives the AI an incredibly massively wide dynamic range.
Right, so it can represent a number that's as massively huge as like the distance between two stars, or a number as microscopically tiny as the width of an atom, and it does all of that within the exact same mathematical framework.
Precisely. And during the backpropagation phase of actually training a neural network when you're teaching it, you absolutely need that microscopic precision.
Because the changes it's making are so small.
Exactly. When the model is calculating gradients to update its billions of weights, those updates are often infinitesimally small. If you don't have those 23 bits of Mantissa that FP32 provides, those tiny gradient updates will literally just truncate to zero. The computer rounds them down to nothing.
And then the network just stops learning.
It stops learning. It's a well-known phenomenon called a vanishing gradient. So FP32 is completely non-negotiable for creating the model in the first place. It is, as Zano calls it in the post, the source of truth.
Okay, but what Zano's testing actually exposes here is the vast, vast difference between training a model and simply running inference on it later. Because once the model is fully trained, right, once all those billions of weights and biases are totally locked in, you don't need backpropagation anymore. You are just passing your text prompt data forward through the network to get an image.
Right, the forward pass. Mm. And what we find, what the data shows us, is that the forward pass is remarkably resilient to lower precision math.
Which brings us to the actual results of Zano's baseline test. So Zano runs the FP32 SDXL generation, gets the image, then runs the FP16 generation, which, just to clarify, drops the exponent down to 5 bits and the Mantissa down to 10 bits.
Which drops the memory footprint significantly, by the way.
Oh, massively. So Zano runs the difference map between the two, applies the harsh 500% gamma boost, and the result is practically nothing.
Nothing. The visual error is completely negligible.
Like it's just that uniform static we talked
about? Yeah, exactly. It is entirely restricted to the realm of standard random mathematical rounding noise. There is absolutely zero structural failure under the floodlight.
So the inference engine basically just looks at the 16-bit math and says, eh, it's close enough. I can still trigger the exact correct activation function. The neural pathways just fire exactly the same way they would have with the super heavy 32-bit math.
That's exactly it. A neuron in a diffusion network doesn't usually care if the incoming value is 0.500000001 or 0.500000002. It really doesn't. As long as that number crosses the activation threshold, the resulting feature map that it spits out is identical.
So for you listening right now, the immediate practical takeaway here is vital for your workflow. If your goal is strictly inference, meaning if you were just sitting at your desk trying to generate cool images, downloading a massive FP32 model is a huge, completely unjustifiable waste of your hardware resources.
It really is. You are burning PCIe bandwidth, you are filling up your VRAM for no reason, and you are slowing down your compute times just to retain mathematical decimal places that the neural network literally ignores during the forward pass anyway.
FP16 is your practical, uncompromised gold standard, period.
It is the absolute ceiling of observable fidelity. Anything above FP16 for local generation is just a phantom pursuit of quality. It's a placebo.
Okay, so we've established FP16 as the king, but here is the brutal reality of where the local AI scene actually is right now. Even our gold standard, FP16, is hitting a massive brick wall because the parameter counts of these new incredible models are just skyrocketing.
They're out of control.
Right. When we look at something like Flux 0.1 Dev, which is a beast, FP16 is just no longer a realistic baseline for a massive portion of the open source community.
It simply exceeds the physical VRAM capacity of the vast majority of consumer and honestly even a lot of prosumer graphics cards on the market today.
So this is exactly where Zano pivots the testing away from, you know, academic theory and into harsh reality. Zano takes Flux 0.1 Dev, sets up a standard 20-step generation using the default Comfy UI template, just to make sure the pipeline is completely standard and reproducible, and pits our FP16 gold standard against the most popular aggressive compression methods that are currently dominating the space.
And the performance metrics that Zano records here are incredibly revealing. Not just about image quality, but about where the bottlenecks actually lie in modern AI hardware.
Yes, the numbers completely expose the difference between memory capacity and memory bandwidth.
Exactly.
Okay, let's run through these stats because they are fascinating. First, the baseline. Flux 0.1 Dev running in full FP16, it demands a staggering 22 gigabytes of VRAM.
22 gigs just to load the weights.
Right. That immediately prices out anyone who isn't running a very expensive RTX 3090 or a 4090 or like a specialized Mac Studio with unified memory. And on the hardware Zano tested, it took exactly 48 seconds to render the 20 steps.
Which is a massive footprint, but honestly, it's a predictable compute time for a 12 billion parameter model.
Okay, next up. Zano tests standard FP8, so 8-bit precision. This is a very common fallback for a lot of users right now, and it does exactly what you'd expect. It cuts the VRAM requirement exactly in half, dropping from 22 gigs down to 11 gigabytes.
Which is great, because that brings it right into the realm of a lot of standard mid to high tier gaming cards.
Right. Totally accessible. And really interestingly, the render time actually drops too. It goes down from 48 seconds to 35 seconds.
Which is entirely logical if you think about the hardware.
Yeah.
You've literally halved the amount of physical data that needs to travel across the memory bus from the VRAM into the streaming multiprocessors on the GPU. Less traffic on the highway equals less time to process the batch.
Totally tracks. But then Xano tests the GGUF format, specifically the Q5KM version, which uses a 5-bit blockwise quantization scheme. And this is where the numbers start to just aggressively contradict conventional logic.
This is where a lot of people get very confused.
Yes, because the GGUF format squeezes this entire 12 billion parameter model down to a tiny 7.6 gigabytes of VRAM, which is incredible. You could theoretically run this on a decent modern laptop, but the render time absolutely balloons. It goes all the way up to 53 seconds.
Right. It is the smallest file footprint by a very wide margin, yet it takes longer to generate the image than the massive uncompressed 22 gigabyte FP16 file.
Okay, I have to pause here because intuitively as a user, this feels completely backwards. I'm struggling to understand where the bottleneck actually is here, because if the GGUF file is only 7.6 gigs, it should easily fit entirely within the VRAM of almost any dedicated modern GPU.
Exactly, it fits easily.
Right, so the memory bus isn't choked with 22 gigs of data trying to squeeze through. So why on earth is the GPU taking 53 seconds to read and process data that is already sitting right there perfectly cache next to the compute cores?
Because you are confusing storage size with operational readiness.
Okay. Break that down for me.
So the GGUF format, and specifically these K-quants, which stands for K-quantization, where they actually use different bit depths for different layers to preserve the most important outliers, it's brilliant, but it is an intensely complex mathematical cipher. It is a highly compressed software format. It is not natively executable code for the tensor cores on your graphics card.
So the GPU can't just look at those 5-bit numbers and instantly do the matrix multiplication.
Exactly. A standard GPU tensor core does not have a 5-bit floating point arithmetic logic unit built into the physical silicon. It literally does not know how to multiply a 5-bit tensor.
So what does it actually do then?
Well, the data sits there in the VRAM, taking up very little space, which is great. But when the compute core actually needs to do the math for a single step of the diffusion process, it has to fetch that 5-bit block from memory, run a complex software decompression algorithm on it, upcast that data back into an FT16 format inside the register.
Wait, it has to convert it back to 16-bit just to do the math?
Yes. It has to upcast it so the ALU can understand it. Then it performs the matrix multiplication, writes it, and then moves on to the very next block to do it all over again.
Oh, wow. So it's basically the overhead of decompression. It's essentially unzipping a file on the fly billions and billions of times per second.
Precisely. You are trading VRAM capacity for pure compute cycles. The tensor cores on your GPU are spending an enormous amount of their actual clock time, not generating the image, but just doing the tedious math to unpack the GGUF weights so they can even be read in the first place.
Wow.
It is a severe compute bottleneck masquerading as a memory solution.
Okay, that clarifies the GGUF time penalty perfectly. That makes so much sense. But it also makes the final set of numbers that Xano recorded even more staggering.
Oh, the NVFP4 numbers.
Yes. So Xano tests this brand new Blackwell native NVFP4 format. This is NVIDIA's new proprietary 4-bit floating point format. The VRAM usage sits at 8.5 gigabytes, so it's actually slightly larger than the 7.6 gigabyte GGUF file we just talked about.
Slightly bigger, yes.
But the render time is 16 seconds.
16 seconds. It renders more than 3 times faster than GGUF and 3 times faster than the FP16 baseline, despite being an 8.5 gigabyte payload.
16 seconds for a 20-step generation on a 12 billion parameter model. I mean, that level of iteration speed fundamentally changes how a creative professional interacts with the tool. You aren't going and getting a coffee while it renders. You are iterating in almost real time.
It's completely workflow altering.
But, and we have to keep Xano's rigid methodology in mind here, speed is completely irrelevant if the math is broken.
Right. If the output is trash, it doesn't matter how fast you generated it.
Exactly. We have to bring out the 500-watt floodlight. We have to look at the gamma-boosted difference maps for this blistering fast NVFP4 format.
And this is where we really have to confront the inescapable reality of data compression. Xano compares that 16-second NVFP4 output directly to the 48-second FP16 gold standard output.
And the hard truth is, no quantization method, Not even this cutting-edge proprietary hardware-native format from NVIDIA is perfectly lossless compared to FP16.
It's just physics, essentially. When you drop from 16 bits of mathematical precision all the way down to 4 bits, you are fundamentally decimating the dynamic range. You are stripping away a massive amount of mathematical nuance.
And Xano's testing shows us exactly where that decimation becomes visible under the 500% gamma boost. NVFP4 doesn't just produce that nice, safe, random high-frequency static we talked about earlier.
No, it exhibits distinct structural shifts.
Right. And Xano specifically isolates exactly where this happens. It happens in areas of extreme, high-contrast lighting.
Yes. Think about things like a bright, glowing neon sign set against a deeply shadowed, pitch-black background.
Right, and you have a great analogy for this that really helped me visualize why it fails there.
Yeah, the topographical map analogy. The structural failure in those high-contrast zones is deeply, deeply tied to how floating-point numbers actually handle gradients. So think of bit depth quantization like you're looking at a topographical map of a mountain.
Okay, let's map this out for the listener. So I've got my map.
Right, so in FD16 or gold standard, you have massive precision. Your topographical map essentially has an elevation contour line drawn for every single inch of vertical gain on that mountain.
Every inch, okay.
If you're mapping a smooth, gradual slope, you have thousands and thousands of tiny contour lines to represent that transition perfectly smoothly. And if you're mapping a sheer cliff, which in image terms is the mathematical equivalent of a harsh transition from extreme neon light right into deep black shadow FP16, still has enough data points to actually plot the steep, continuous curve of that cliff face.
Because it has all those tiny one-inch lines, but NVFP4 is a much, much lower resolution map.
Exactly. In NVFP4, because you literally only have 4 bits of precision to work with, your topographical map only has an elevation contour line drawn every 10 feet.
Oh, wow. That's a huge difference.
It is. Now, if you're in a flat plane, like a flat blue sky in an image, you might not really notice those missing lines. This guy still looks blue. But when you try to map that exact same sheer cliff, that extreme high contrast lighting gradient, you physically cannot represent a smooth slope anymore. The map is forced to just draw massive 10-foot blocky stair steps.
Right, because it just truncates the intermediate values. There simply isn't a 4-bit representation for the exact decimal it needs to draw a smooth 1-inch transition.
Correct. It has to jump from one available number to the next available number, and the gap between them is huge. And when the diffusion model is forced to step down that light gradient in massive truncated mathematical chunks, the structural manifold of the image warps.
The gradient literally bands.
Yes, it bands. The structural boundary of the light completely shifts. And under Xano's 500% gamma boost, you can actually see those exact 10-foot stair steps clearly outlining the neon light in the image.
It's wild to look at. So the hard truth is completely undeniable here. NVFP4 mathematically degrades the integrity of the image. The structural math actively breaks in high contrast scenarios.
It does break.
And honestly, this is the section of Xano's research that absolutely upends everything we literally just talked about regarding fidelity. Because while we assume naturally that structural degradation makes an image objectively worse.
Because that's what logic dictates.
Yeah. But Xano reveals a scenario where mathematically compromising the neural network actually yields a vastly superior aesthetic result.
It is a phenomenal paradox,
yeah.
Truly. It deeply touches on the concept of overfitting and how these AI models actually learn geometric priors during their training.
Okay, let's talk about the flex chin. Because if you spend any time at all generating human portraits with the FLUX 0.1 dev model, you know exactly what this artifact is. It is basically inescapable.
It's infamous. It is a severe overtrained bias in the network. Whenever FLUX 0.1 attempts to render a human jawline, it almost always defaults to this incredibly rigid, sharp, hyper-pronounced bone structure.
Yes. It looks so unnatural. It almost looks like a sculpted plastic prosthetic attached to their face.
Right. And when Xano tests the FP16 gold standard, our mathematically perfect baseline, right?
Right.
The flux chin is rendered with absolute high-fidelity perfection. It is sharp and terrible.
And it's there in the FP8 version, too. It's there in the GGUF version.
Exactly. Because all of those higher precision formats actually have enough mathematical depth to accurately reproduce the exact weights and biases the model mistakenly learned during its training. They are faithfully, accurately executing a flaw.
They possess the math to be perfectly wrong.
Well said. They possess the precision to resolve the specific local minima that the network falls into when it generates that jawline.
But then,
yeah,
Xana looks at the output from the heavily compressed, mathematically inferior NVFP4 format. And the big reveal here is that NVFT4 completely bypasses the flask chin.
Completely ignores it.
The jawline it generates in 4-bit is softer. It has natural curvature. It actually looks organically human. It completely drops the rigid artifact that plagues every single higher precision format.
And this is where we have to connect that topographical map metaphor we just used back to the actual concept of the latent space. Like, why does a mathematically inferior 10-foot contour map produce a better-looking human face?
I am genuinely trying to wrap my head around this, because how does literally losing data make the AI somehow smarter about human anatomy?
It doesn't make it smarter. Exactly. It essentially forces it to generalize by acting as a harsh, low-pass mathematical filter.
Okay, to explain that.
Think about how a neural network actually stores that flux chin in its weights. It is a highly specific, very rigid set of localized numbers that the model overlearned from its data set. It requires very precise floating point decimal values to execute that exact sharp geometric angle on the jaw.
Ah, so it needs those tiny 1-inch contour lines to draw that super sharp, unnatural angle.
Exactly. But NVFP4 only has the 10-foot contour lines. When you compress the model all the way down to 4 bits, you truncate the highly specific decimals required to activate that overtrained, rigid structural pathway.
It literally cannot access the bad habit because the numbers to trigger it don't exist anymore.
Precisely. The model lacks the mathematical precision to recreate the sharp artifact. So what happens? Because it can't resolve the specific sharp local minima of the bad chin, the math essentially falls back onto a broader, smoother, much more generalized prior of what a face should look like.
Wow. The truncation literally just sands off the sharpest, most biased data points in the model.
Yes. The loss of mathematical precision inadvertently acts as an aesthetic regularization technique. It physically prevents the model from expressing its worst, most overtrained habits.
That implies something so profound about how we train these models in the first place, you know? Like, the model actually knows what a soft, natural face looks like. That data is buried somewhere deep in the generalized latent space. But the rigid, overtrained FP32 math forces it to output the ugly chin instead. And by starving the model of bits, we force it to fall back on its more natural, generalized knowledge.
It's an incredible dynamic. It demonstrates, without a doubt, that mathematical fidelity to the trained weights is not always synonymous with aesthetic quality. Sometimes perfectly accurate math gives you an ugly image.
Okay, so we've seen the profound aesthetic and performance impact of NVFP4 on static image generation. But Xana points out in the article that you really cannot fully understand why NVFP4 is performing these 16-second generation miracles just by looking at the software layer.
No, you have to look at the hardware.
Right, you have to look at how the software format interacts with the physical silicon of the GPU. And Xana illustrates this hardware-software synergy by stepping away from static images entirely and looking at AI video generation.
Which is brilliant. Yeah. Because video generation is the ultimate stress test for any quantization method.
Because of the temporal consistency.
Exactly. It demands extreme temporal stability. Any structural mathematical failure in a single frame, like the banding we saw in the neon light, will instantly cascade and flicker when it's in motion.
So Xana tests the WAN 2.2 video generation model and sets up a side-by-side comparison between the GGUF format, specifically that Q4KM version, and the NVFT4 format.
And remember the context here. Xana is analyzing this video output with the exact same rigor we discussed earlier, looking closely for structural breakdown frame by frame.
Right. But looking at the two videos playing side by side, Xana reports that there is almost zero visible degradation in the NVFP4 version compared to the GGUF version.
Almost none.
The motion is fluid. The structural consistency is totally maintained across the frames. The only distinct difference Xana could actually find in the entire test was a single wisp of smoke.
Just one wisp.
Yeah, a wisp of smoke that generated in the GGUF background but was just kind of truncated out of the NVFP4 background.
And honestly, a single missing wisp of background smoke is the very definition of acceptable variance, especially when you factor in the massive performance gains you're getting.
Totally. But the critical question here is why? How does a 4-bit format maintain that level of temporal consistency across frames and still run so incredibly fast?
Right. And this brings us right back to the bottleneck we identified earlier with GGUF. we have to talk about the translation tax.
Let's break down the translation tax, because this really seems to be the fundamental dividing line between standard quantization methods and hardware-native quantization methods.
It absolutely is. So we established earlier that when a typical GPU runs a GGUF file, the physical tensor cores, the actual arithmetic logic units, or ALUs, that are etched into the silicon chip, they don't actually speak GGUF math.
Right, because GGUF is basically a software-level algorithmic compression scheme.
Yes. It's the zip file that needs to be unpacked on the fly.
So the GPU has to pause and do the math to unzip it.
Exactly. The GPU has to pull that 5-bit GGUF weight from the VRAM, move it into the streaming multiprocessor, run compute cycles just to dequantize it, upcast it into a 16-bit float within the register, execute the actual matrix multiplication, and then write the result back.
And it's doing that for every single calculation.
Billions of times. That continuous cycle of dequantization and upcasting requires millions of extra clock cycles, and it eats up immense memory bandwidth. That exact overhead, that is the translation tax.
It's a massive, massive bottleneck at the very core of the processor.
It is. But yeah. NVFP4 fundamentally bypasses this entire process.
How? Because it's still a compressed format, right?
It is. But NVFP4 isn't just a clever mathematical software trick. It is an intrinsic part of the NVIDIA Blackwell hardware architecture itself.
Oh, so it's physically built into the chip.
Yes. The physical silicon of the Blackwell tensor cores features dedicated logic gates that are engineered specifically to natively execute 4-bit floating point math.
So the tensor core doesn't need to upcast the NVFP4 data to 16 bits to do the multiplication at all.
Exactly. It ingests the 4-bit data straight from the VRAM, and it processes the matrix multiplication natively right there within the 4-bit registers. There is absolutely no software decompression layer. There is no upcasting. The data pathway from the memory controller directly to the ALU is completely direct and frictionless. It entirely evades the translation tax.
And that's why it's so fast.
That's exactly why. Bypassing that tax results in drastically reduced power consumption on the card, and it gives us those blistering 16-second generation times we saw earlier.
It's basically the difference between running like a video game emulator on your PC, where the software has to constantly translate every single instruction from one console to another, versus running code natively on the bare metal hardware it was designed for.
That is a perfect way to look at it. Bare metal execution always wins.
And to further illustrate just how incredibly powerful this Blackwell hardware synergy actually is, Zano highlights an adjacent feature that was tested on this architecture, the NVIDIA RTX video upscaler.
Right, this is a perfect example of dedicated silicon accelerating a very specific neural task.
So Zano ran a test taking a 6-second, highly compressed 0.4 megapixel video, which is essentially just a low-res thumbnail video, and pushed it through the hardware RTX upscaler.
And the results are crazy.
The hardware upscaled the entire Claire to a crisp, high-fidelity 1080p in just 6.4 seconds.
It's practically instantaneous.
It is literally processing the complex neural upscaling faster than real time. It is writing the high-res 1080p frames faster than you could actually sit there and watch the originally 6-second video.
Because when you remove those clunky software abstraction layers,
yeah,
and you allow the neural network to execute directly on optimized dedicated silicon pathways, the throughput is just staggering. It's a completely different paradigm.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of technical ground here today. I mean, we started with the pixel level mathematics of 500% gamma boost. We broke down the floating point truncation of FP16 versus FP32. We explored the massive translation tax bottleneck of GGUF, the topographical sheer cliff failures of NVFP4 gradients.
Latent space regularization of the flux chin.
Right. The flux chin, and finally, the bare metal silicon execution of the Blackwell architecture. That is a lot of dense information.
It's a very dense matrix of variables, for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, Zano's ultimate thesis in this post is that we have to take all this raw objective data and we have to actually apply it to a practical workflow decision matrix.
Exactly. Because the era of just going to a site, downloading the file with the most stars or the most likes, and just blindly hoping for the best, that era is completely over. You really have to engineer your workflow based on your specific hardware bottlenecks and your specific aesthetic requirements.
Yes.
So let's synthesize Zano's findings into clear, actionable paths for you listening right now.
All right, let's break it down. So the first path really addresses the purist. Let's assume you are generating highly technical compositions. You are dealing with extreme high contrast lighting, you know, the neon signs and the dark rainy alleys. And you absolutely need those mathematical gradients to resolve flawlessly without any banding or structural collapse.
And crucially for this path, you possess a GPU with at least 24 gigabytes of VRAM.
Yes. Hardware is the gatekeeper here. So if that is you, your path is very clear.
Yeah.
You stick to the FP16 gold standard.
Right. You just accept the 48-second render times. You embrace the massive file footprint on your hard drive, because your primary constraint in your workflow is uncompromised structural fidelity. And as we established, FP16 is the mathematical ceiling for inference. You're actively choosing precision over efficiency.
Exactly. But what if you are on the complete opposite end of the hardware spectrum? Let's say you are running an older RTX 3060. Or maybe a laptop with only 8 gigabytes of VRAM.
Yeah.
You simply cannot physically load an 11 gigabyte FP8 file, let alone a massive 22 gigabyte FP16 file.
It just will crash.
It'll crash every time.
Yeah. So
then your path is the GGUF format.
Specifically, the Q5KM lock quantized version that Zano tested. Because that format shrinks the massive 12 billion parameter model down to a highly manageable 7.6 gigabytes.
Right. Now, you will pay a massive translation tax for this. You will suffer those 53-second render times because your tensor cores are constantly unpacking the math.
Mm.
But you are trading your time to solve a hard memory limit. GGUF is essentially the bridge that allows underpowered hardware to even participate in the current generation of these massive models.
It gets you in the door.
Exactly. And finally, we have the third path, which really represents the bleeding edge of the Blackwell ecosystem.
So let's say your primary objective as a creator is rapid iteration. You just need to generate dozens and dozens of concepts a minute to find the perfect composition.
Right.
You possess the Blackwell hardware required to utilize those native silicon pathways. And importantly, you are generating human subjects, and you want to actively suppress the overtrained rigidity of artifacts like the FluxChain.
If that is your specific workflow, NVFP4 is your definitive standard moving forward.
Because you are making a very calculated trade-off, you accept the minor mathematical degradation in extreme high contrast gradients, because in exchange, you get 16-second render times, zero translation tax on the GPU, and a low-pass mathematical filter that inadvertently generates softer, more organic facial priors.
You're choosing speed and generalized aesthetics over rigid mathematical precision.
It is entirely about understanding the specific failure states of your tools and then leveraging those exact failure states to your advantage.
Exactly.
Which honestly changes my entire perspective on quantization as a whole, because I've always treated data compression as just a necessary evil, you know, like a destructive process we just tolerate to make things run. But seeing how truncating the bits actually fix the FluxChain, it makes me realize that data loss isn't always a negative.
It really reframes the whole concept. It reframes quantization from a purely logistical necessity into something that honestly borders on algorithmic curation.
Algorithmic curation, I like that.
And that actually leads to a rather profound implication that extends far beyond Zano's current testing in the article.
No. I am ready for the final provocative thought. Where does this lead us?
Well, we've established today that the NVFP4 format inadvertently acts as an aesthetic filter, right?
Mm-hmm.
By truncating the highly specific decimal precision required to render an overtrained artifact.
Right. It smoothed out the FluxChain by simply forgetting the rigid math required to draw it.
Exactly. It was a happy accident of the 4-bit format. But it raises a deeply fascinating prospect for the future of model training and fine-tuning.
Okay.
Could AI engineers intentionally weaponize targeted quantization as an actual creative editing tool?
Wait, like intentionally destroying data in specific layers of the network to physically sculpt the output?
Yes, exactly. Imagine a process where developers analyze the latent space of a base model, and they identify the specific layers and attention heads that are aggressively enforcing an undesirable bias.
Whether that's a rigid jawline or maybe an oversaturation of color or some repetitive compositional habit it learned from the FP32 training data.
Exactly. So instead of trying to fine-tune those bad habits out with millions of new corrected images, which takes immense compute, what if they just applied an aggressive targeted quantization only to those specific problematic layers?
Oh, wow. You would selectively starve the network's bad habits of the exact bit depth they need to manifest.
Yes.
Forcing those specific features to fall back to a smoother, generalized prior while leaving the rest of the network all the good stuff at high precision.
Exactly. You're using mathematical truncation as a highly surgical scalpel.
That is a brilliant, entirely new way to think about managing neural networks.
It really suggests a future where we don't just compress for size, we compress for style.
I love that. Compress for style. Well, thank you all for joining us on this deep dive. I highly encourage you to go look at your own comfy UI pipelines tonight. Maybe render out a difference map, apply that crazy 500% gamma boost, and see exactly what kind of math your GPU is actually running under the hood. Until next time.
Thanks for tuning in to the Creepy Bits AI Digest. To explore this topic further, you'll find all the relevant links, resources, and detailed show notes for this episode over at zano.se. And if you're enjoying these deep dives and want to help support the show, please consider subscribing on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. Your support is what makes future episodes possible. Thanks again for listening.